composer Leonard Rosenman had better things to do in 1954 than write a movie score. After all, he'd studied privately with Arnold Schoenberg. He'd had lessons as well with Roger Sessions and Luigi Della Piccola. These were all the big names, serious music, 12-tone masters of the day. Rosenman was teaching piano, composing, minding his own business, when Ilya Kazan offered him a job scoring his new film East of Eden, starring James Dean. Somehow, even though Rosenman resisted it, he took to it. He liked to brag that it took him about 8 minutes to come up with that classic East of Eden tune.
Well, that's what you always said. You know, it took him 8 minutes. Just start your stopwatch, and I'll write this tune.
Composer and author George Burt studied, taught, and composed alongside Rosenman for many years.
Of course, you know, Leonard did exaggerate. That's one thing that I really loved him for. His stories were great.
Rosenman's story, and this one seems to have been true, was that the star of the moment, James Dean, whom he'd met at a gathering in New York, had knocked on his door late one night asking for piano lessons. Dean and Rosenman became friends and later roommates, and it was Dean who suggested to Ilya Kazan that Rosenman write the score for East of Eden. While we're name-dropping, it was Aaron Copland who advised the young Rosenman to go ahead and take the job.
Copland had presented him and picked him out as one of the up-and-coming composers, and he was friends with Bernstein, and, you know, lots of concert things were happening.
Conductor and friend of Rosenman's, Scott Dunn.
And then the minute East of Eden happened, and he became this, suddenly this celebrated star out here in Hollywood, he was, at least to his mind, he completely dropped from the New York concert scene.
That's how it was in those days. Either you were New York, or you were Hollywood. Either you were a serious composer, or a film composer.
So that was a frustration that he carried all his life.
What Leonard Rosenman did in the face of that frustration was to tackle what he saw as the failings of film music, one by one, says his friend, composer Jane Brockman.
When he got to Hollywood, he said he couldn't believe it. All the violins played the same part.
It sounded so old-fashioned, he thought. There he was in the middle of the 50s, and film music was stuck in the lush, romantic European style of the 30s and 40s. He wanted to move it along. Emboldened by his success with East of Eden, Rosenman dove into his score for The Cobweb, a star-studded melodrama of 1955 that takes place in a psychiatric clinic. Other movie composers may have hinted at modernism, but The Cobweb was the first full-scale 12-tone film score. Rosenman wrote his studies with Schoenberg right into the music.
He did open it up to new language, and it's not like he just added it for the sake of adding it. It always served the dramatic purposes of the film.
The Hollywood wisdom of the moment was that the thorny atonal score was going to be thrown out. But to everyone's surprise, including the composers, it was embraced, recorded, and praised by the MGM music department. The time was right.
Why don't you analyze my Oedipus complex for my lousy father?
Suppose we let me determine the course of treatment.
Sadly, nothing could help The Cobweb as a movie.
So don't you know how to do any id analysis here? Isn't that the classic procedure?
Years later, Rosenman was teaching along with George Burt at USC and had reason to see the film again.
A real woman.
And he played Cobweb for one of the classes. And after the class, he came to me and said, George, he said, what a dreadful film. He hadn't seen it for 30 years.
I am a woman. I want to be one, but I have to feel like I'm desired.
He just couldn't believe how bad it was.
Everyone thinks you're desirable.
It didn't matter. Cobweb brought Rosenman great notoriety as the man who had updated the musical language of cinema. Next argument. Rosenman felt movies were just using too much music. The more contemporary attitude, he thought, was to use silence as well. And the composer played with that idea.
Sorry we had to get you up at this hour, Mr. Grant.
By the time of Fantastic Voyage in the 60s, he made his boldest move to date.
Where are we going?
I can't tell you that either.
Fantastic Voyage was groundbreaking in that there wasn't a note of music until, I don't know, 40 minutes into the film or something like that.
Fantastic Voyage, you may remember, is a science fiction film in which a miniaturized ship is traveling through someone's body.
The real drama starts when a little ship is injected into the bloodstream of this individual.
Music starts at minute 38, to be exact.
This amazing music begins, which sounds like something out of Wozzeck. I mean, it's... it's definitely not Franz Waxman we're listening to anymore, you know. It is very, very modern music, and finally it's being appreciated.
There were many more films, nearly 50, to get the Rosenman treatment, including Rebel Without a Cause, Star Trek IV, and the TV film Sybil, in which he experimented with microtonality, using instruments and voices to illustrate the title character's split personality.
You know, always trying to push the boundaries.
On network television, no less. But actually, there was a split in Rosenman, too.
He said constantly that he made a big mistake by coming to Los Angeles because he could never get back to New York. They wouldn't accept him and they wouldn't play his music anymore. So he suffered from it.
The fact is, Leonard Rosenman was right. Once he became a film composer, his serious music did take a back seat, at least as far as the commercial world was concerned. But he managed to bring the practices and conceits of then-modern concert music into the movies. Ultimately, frustrated though he may have been, it seems as if the composer knew he'd made a contribution.
During the time that I knew him, he really did feel that he had saved film music, and maybe he had, you know.
Whether he had or hadn't, there are other, simpler reasons to be interested in Rosenman's work.
It's just that the scores he wrote were so good. They were really, just really good.
Reason enough. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishko.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.